So the next presentation is Death on the Street, 12-Year Observational Study of Mortality of a Rough Sleeper Population in Boston, Massachusetts, 2000 through 2011. Our speakers today are Dr. Jim O'Connell and Jill Roncardi. Dr. Jim O'Connell is the president and founding physician of the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program and a street team physician. He has been caring for homeless people on the streets since 1985. Jill Roncardi is a physician assistant who has worked on the street team at the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program for over a decade and is currently a doctoral candidate at Harvard School of Public Health, focusing her research on street homelessness. Thank you.
So we keep getting confused, I'm sorry. Okay, I just wanted to introduce this quickly because this study sort of comes out of a team effort back home in Boston. And Jill Roncardi, who's now pursuing a doctorate at the School of Public Health, has really been putting together all the statistics. But I thought I'd steal the thunder since Jill just passed her orals on this past Monday and now gets to do her thing. So I wanted to say congratulations. But anyway, I'm going to just give you a quick introduction and then Jill will tell you about the design. But the background we felt was a little bit important, only because when we started to do this, it was back in the late 1990s, and we realized that we had no literature at all on the rough sleeper population. We didn't even have a definition of rough sleepers, except those are the people that don't seem to come into shelters. And we had started many, many years ago caring for that group, and there's a classic picture that I don't know if you've seen, but this was taken by one of our patients back in 1999. She lived under the Longfellow Bridge, which is right next to Mass General and goes over the Charles River. But it was a picture she took of her street friends, and they were all patients of ours at the time. And she gave us this picture, and it was stunning to us because it takes place on the grounds of Mass General Hospital. That's a little park we have in the hospital grounds called Mousie Park. And you can see there's a bunch of relatively young, healthy-looking people there. There is one woman who's hiding because she didn't want to be the only woman in the picture. And when we look at that picture, over time, what we start to realize is that those were very vulnerable street folks. They all had insurance. They lived on the streets chronically, and there's only two of them alive now. And it started to let us realize this is a subpopulation of the homeless that is really pretty vulnerable, but we understand very little about what to do. Our Healthcare for the Homeless program, many of you may know, we started as one of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation programs. We had a pretty feisty community stakeholder group of about 88 people that forced us to do our model the way we are. And they insisted on continuity of care that went from shelter and street right to the hospital. They wanted us to work in teams, which is kind of interesting back in 1984. And our teams are usually doctors with nurse practitioners and physician assistants and other workers. And then they also forced us to do respite care. So we had to open our first respite program back in September of 1985, and that all came from the community, and I could tell you more about each of those things as we go along. But the model has evolved over time, and this is a busy slide. Just suffice it to say that we're now a relatively big freestanding healthcare for the homeless program. The nice thing is that we've been embraced by two hospitals, by Boston City Hospital, now Boston Medical Center, which is the real city hospital, and then Mass General Hospital, which has really been a blessing. We have clinics, our staff have clinics in those two hospitals every day, but then we get to do clinics in most of the shelters and outreach sites in Boston, which has been another story of itself, that it's a unified healthcare system now within the shelters. It's kind of cool. We have a 104-bed respite program. We have an electronic medical record that MGH did for us back in 1996, if you can believe that. So everybody's on the same electronic record. And we've grown now to where we're about a $40 million a year program, and we serve about 12,000 men, women, and children each year. The early days of this, or the genesis of our street kind of obsession, I guess you might call it, was that despite getting all our clinicians down to out to the shelters and places we thought people would be comfortable, there was that group of people who won't come in. And in Boston, if you don't know, I've been doing this almost 28 years now. We've had two mayors in that time, by the way. Things change slowly in Boston. But both mayors have been phenomenally committed to homeless services and have guaranteed a shelter bed for any homeless adult who wants one. So you can walk into any of the shelters and they will guarantee you a bed. And you can be in any state of sobriety or inebriation. You're not eliminated from that. So the street population in Boston tend to be those people that really, for whatever reasons, will not go in. And it's not because they're drinking or not because they're doing drugs. It's for whatever reasons. And you can, you are all familiar with those things. But we, the State Department of Public Health gave Pine Street Inn money to start an outreach van in early in the winter of 1986. And this is a van. It's a van that brings foods, brings food, blankets, and stuff like that. It does not, was deliberately not a medical van, kind of an interesting twist, because they were afraid medical folks would scare the street folks. Okay. So we were able to start working on that. We have been on Mondays and Wednesdays. I've been doing that since way back in the beginning. And it goes out from 9 o'clock at night till 5 every morning. The van's out 365 days a year, so they know all of the street folks in Boston. And in like Houston, where I've been before, and I, since I'm a Rhode Islander, I can fit my whole state in your city, Boston's like this big, okay? So we can actually do something like that. Geographically, it's a little bit more conducive to that. But the van folks know everybody outside. What we the van was originally funded for only 3 months, though, during the cold months, because that's when it was thought that the people were most vulnerable. And this I threw in there because it was the earliest study. There's a story behind this because we weren't allowed to do research initially because of an advocacy issue. But this was not really research, but just documenting stuff. This was done on a Mac 512. It was the first computer we had in our program. So just so you know, when I started, there were no computers. Okay. And we grabbed this. We thought it was the coolest thing going. But anyway, what we did was document when people were dying, and it looked like it was not only during the cold months, but it was all year long. And that was the first thing we could bring with the shelter community to the state and say, can you fund the van all year round, which it has been now since 1986. This is a picture I love of Stephen Wong. Many of you may know Stephen. He's now in Toronto, and he's one of the foremost researchers now and one of the real brilliant minds on homelessness. But he was a doc with us for about 6 years. He's phenomenal. This is him working out at Long Island Shelter, creatively figuring out how to get somebody who's very deaf to hear what he's saying. But Stephen did several studies on mortality using the folks that had used our clinics back in the 1990s, and came up with several studies, including one which showed the relative risks for who would die. When you look at who comes into your clinic, who's homeless, who might die and who may not. This study has now been duplicated by Travis Baggett, one of our newer docs, and it's in press now, but it's an interesting twist. It will show much of the same stuff, but with a changing causes. But what we didn't get in all of that was what happens to the street folks. We know what happens overall to the homeless population, but haven't been able to subdivide what's going on with the street folks, who are these lost souls. We do have, interestingly, we've had a point-in-time count in Boston since 1987, and this is the street count from each of those, which Joe put together since 1987. And you can sort of see, by the way, this count is done on a cold winter night between 9 and midnight, and the methodology is probably not as exhaustive as you can do, but it's a small enough town that it's just simply divide the town up into blocks and everybody goes through each block. But you can see that the street population tends to vary. Remember, this will be a cold night in December, so only the hardcore folks will be out then. There was another study we did with Dr. Koh, who was then he's now the Assistant Secretary of Health, but he was Commissioner of Public Health back then, was looking at an outbreak of deaths, which really motivated us to do what we're starting to do now, because we've been doing this street outreach work for a long time. We do the nighttime stuff. This is the day stuff, and I think Pat Perry is back there, one of our docs who's now moved on to Pittsburgh, where he's doing phenomenal things there. But that's Jill giving flu shots during flu shot season out in the streets with Pat, who's an internist on our team. This is my favorite slide of integrated care. This is Eileen Riley, our psychiatrist on our team, with Pat, who's our internist, and Cheryl, who's a nurse. She can only see her arm, but talking to one of our patients who's having a real struggle with getting some medical problems taken care of, but his psychiatric issues are really getting in the way. So one of the things that's been interesting about street folks that we were able to parlay here is trying to integrate that medical care and mental health care. Jill, let me pass it to you here.
So I'm just going to briefly talk to you about the design of the study that's been ongoing since the year 2000. So it's a 12-year prospective closed cohort study design. We identified 119 rough sleepers by applying high-risk for dying criteria, which I'll explain a little bit more in another slide. So all the members of the cohort are defined by the presence of sleeping rough outside for 6 months or more, 6 consecutive months or more, and being high-risk for dying. The cohort was created from identifying the people through our electronic medical record and a supplemental database that we've been keeping as we encounter people on the street, and if they didn't exist in the electronic medical record, we would keep their names and their information in a supplemental database. So no members were added over time. It's a closed cohort, and everybody in the cohort was followed prospectively. The high risk for dying criteria is based on the study that Jim was talking about a little bit earlier, the study by Stephen Wong and Jim in 1997. So, and also clinical, it was also informed by clinical information as well, knowing this group of people for as long as they did. So the criteria are being an adult, so 18 years old or older, sleeping outside for at least 6 months consecutively or more. Most of them are very many more months than six, and one or more of the following seven criteria. So having trimorbidity, which means co-occurring medical, mental health, and substance abuse diagnoses, being admitted to the hospital, emergency room, or a respite unit for those medical problems at least one time in the year, having three or more emergency department visits in the past 3 months, being older than 60 years old, having a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS, having a diagnosis of cirrhosis, end-stage liver disease, or renal disease. And if you have anywhere in your history, in your medical history, a history of frostbite, hypothermia, or immersion foot, those are the criteria that we use to identify the people in our cohort. The data was collected systematically and recorded prospectively. It was maintained in that supplemental database that I talked about. The sources are our electronic medical record and also the charts at Mass General and Boston Medical Center, the database that I mentioned as well, retrieving the death certificates when somebody dies, and getting additional data from the National Death Index. And recording all the information that happens during our team meetings and obtaining Medicaid data, basically, on emergency room and hospital usage. Some of the demographic data is that there's a 3-to-1 ratio of male to female, so 75% male, 25% female. The race and ethnicity profile is similar to Boston as a whole, as well as the age ranges, except for that the cohort is just slightly older than the average age in Boston. Health insurance, which is surprising if you look at things nationally, but not so much in Massachusetts, where we've had a pretty robust Medicaid program for quite a while. So at baseline, 80% of the cohort was covered and 20% without. And Jim is going to talk about the results now.
So just to give you the simple, the 25,000 foot version of the results. So 12 years later, I suppose not surprising to anybody here, but 50% of the cohort is now dead, which staggers us when we think about it. And you notice another 9 are in nursing homes, which means they're now permanently those are people permanently in a nursing home. Only one is incarcerated. You can see there's 2 that went into shelter. Most of the cohort that was still alive has been housed, and we still have about 6 on the streets. What surprised me probably most about this study is we only lost 7 to follow-up during a 12-year period, which I keep thinking is, you know, we thought in the beginning that this was going to be the hardest group to follow, and in many ways they were much more ritualized and contained than we had ever expected. So that was a surprise, and I think a real tribute to, I think, the partners we have throughout the city who are really good. So you can call anyone on the van at some night and say, can you find Joe for us, because we're really worried about him, and they will find him. These are the causes of death, also kind of surprising. Cancer is a leading cause of death. As you go down the line, most of these tend to be medical problems that have a backdrop to substance abuse and other problems behind them, as you might not be surprised. But it's surprisingly medical, I guess that's what caused. There were 4 or 6 overdoses. In studies that we've now done recently, that Travis has been doing, overdose is now starting to overtake everything else, so that's becoming a growing issue. But notice we only have had one person die from the heat and one from the cold, and I apologize about that HD at the end. That's Huntington's disease. We actually had one woman who got Huntington's disease and died from that. The cancers, by the way, just to give you the headline, there was no breast cancer, no cervical cancer, no prostate cancer in this group. It was all lung cancer or head and neck cancer, all the cancers related to smoking and probably alcohol. So our efforts at doing pap smears and mammograms on the street seem to be of not particularly, or maybe they were good because we avoided that, but we don't think so. And this, you may see, the earliest data we got from Medicaid, and the only data we've been able to get from Medicaid so far, was just a five-year glimpse of that group of 119, and that's the number of emergency room visits they had during that five-year period, which if ever this study, and Jill is looking at this from a much more rigorous academic story, but if I look at it from just an indictment of our own system, here's a group of people that have come that frequently to our healthcare system, and their crude mortality rate is 50%. So something's amiss in what we're able to do. And the other thing that I would just share with you at the end is that this is also an insured group of people. This is not a lack of insurance. So I think the thing I would throw out, one of the lessons from Massachusetts, is that as we now have, 97% of our folks are insured, and that has been fabulous. I think people have been really happy. But the ability of our healthcare systems to adjust to the special problems of different vulnerable populations has not always come hand in glove with that. And I think that's going to be the struggle we have as we go ahead. So we're getting everybody insurance is the absolute necessary condition for making us solving the problem. It's not sufficient. We're going to need a lot of creative approaches to how to reach out to this population. I think I'll stop there, and I think my time is up here, so thank you.